But what kind of offering? The 12-inch Leopardon robot I'd acquired after completing the second gate didn't seem to fit. I tried placing it on the altar anyway, and nothing happened. I placed the robot back in my inventory and stood there for a moment, thinking. Then I remembered something else from the 2112 liner notes. I pulled them up and scanned over them again. There was my answer, in the text that preceded Part 3, Discovery. Behind my beloved waterfall, in the little room that was hidden beneath the cave, I found it. I brushed away the dust of the years and picked it up, holding it reverently in my hands. I had no idea what it might be, but it was beautiful. I learned to lay my fingers across the wires and to turn the keys to make them sound differently. As I struck the wires with my other hand, I produced my first harmonious sounds, and soon, my own music. I found the waterfall near the southern edge of the city, just inside the curved wall of the atmospheric dome. As soon as I found it, I activated my jet boots and flew over the foaming river below the falls, then passed through the waterfall itself. My haptic suit did its best to simulate the sensation of torrents of falling water striking my body, but it felt more like someone pounding on my head, shoulders, and back with a bundle of sticks. Once I'd passed through the falls to the other side, I found the opening of a cave and went inside. The cave narrowed into a long tunnel, which terminated in a small, cavernous room. I searched the room and discovered that one of the stalagmites protruding from the floor was slightly worn around the tip. I grabbed the stalagmite and pulled it toward me, but it didn't budge. I tried pushing, and it gave, bending as if on some hidden hinge, like a lever. I heard a rumble of grinding stone behind me, and I turned to see a trap door opening in the floor. A hole had also opened in the roof of the cave, casting a brilliant shaft of light down through the open trap door, into a tiny hidden chamber below. I took an item out of my inventory, a wand that could detect hidden traps, magical or otherwise. I used it to make sure the area was clear, then jumped down through the trap door and landed on the dusty floor of the hidden chamber. It was a tiny cube-shaped room with a large, rough-hewn stone standing against the north wall. Embedded in the stone, neck first, was an electric guitar. I recognized its design from the 2112 concert footage I'd watched during the trip here. It was a 1974 Gibson Les Paul, the exact guitar used by Alex Lifeson during the 2112 tour. I grinned at the absurd Arthurian image of the guitar in the stone. Like every Gunter, I'd seen John Boorman's film Excalibur many times, so it seemed obvious what I should do next. I reached out with my right hand, grasped the neck of the guitar, and pulled. The guitar came free of the stone with a prolonged metallic shing. As I held the guitar over my head, the metallic ringing segued into a guitar power chord that echoed throughout the cave. I stared down at the guitar, about to activate my jet boots again to fly back up through the trap door and out of the cave. But then an idea occurred to me, and I froze. James Halliday had taken guitar lessons for a few years in high school. That was what had first inspired me to learn to play. I'd never held an actual guitar, but on a virtual axe, I could totally shred. I searched my inventory and found a guitar pick. Then I opened my Grail diary and pulled up the sheet music for 2112, along with the guitar tablature for the song Discovery, which describes the hero's discovery of the guitar in a room hidden behind a waterfall. As I began to play the song, the sound of the guitar blasted off the chamber walls and back out through the cave, despite the absence of any electricity or amplifiers. When I finished playing the first measure of discovery, a message briefly appeared, carved into the stone from which I'd pulled the guitar. The first was ringed in red metal, the second in green stone. The third is clearest crystal and cannot be unlocked alone. In seconds, the words began to vanish, fading from the stone along with the strains of the last note I'd played on the guitar. I quickly snapped a screenshot of the riddle, already trying to sort out its meaning. It was about the third gate, of course, and how it could not be unlocked alone. Had the Sixers played the song and discovered this message? I seriously doubted it. They would have pulled the guitar from the stone and immediately returned it to the temple. If so, they probably didn't know there was some sort of trick to unlocking the third gate, and that would explain why they still hadn't reached the egg. I returned to the temple and placed the guitar on the altar. As I did, the towering computers around me began to emit a cacophony of sound, like a grand orchestra tuning up. The noise built to a deafening crescendo before ceasing abruptly. Then there was a flash of light on the altar, and the guitar transformed into the crystal key. When I reached out and picked up the key, a chime sounded, and my score on the scoreboard increased by 25,000 points. When added to the 200,000 I'd received for clearing the second gate, that brought my total score up to 353,000 points, 1,000 points more than Sorrento. I was back in first place. But I knew this was no time to celebrate. I quickly examined the crystal key, tilting it up to study its glittering, faceted surface. I didn't see any words etched there, but I did find a small monogram etched in the center of the key's crystal handle, a single calligraphic letter A that I recognized immediately. The same letter A appeared in the character symbol box on James Halliday's first Dungeons & Dragons character sheet. The very same monogram also appeared on the dark robes of his famous Oasis avatar, Anorak. And, I knew, that same emblematic letter adorned the front gates of Castle Anorak, his avatar's impregnable stronghold. In the first few years of the hunt, Gunters had swarmed like angry insects to any Oasis location that seemed like a possible hiding place for the three keys, specifically planets originally coded by Halliday himself. Chief among these was the planet Thonia, a painstaking recreation of the fantasy world Halliday had created for his high school Dungeons & Dragons campaign, and also the setting of many of his early video games. Thonia had become the Gunters' Mecca. Like everyone else, I'd felt obligated to make a pilgrimage there to visit Castle Anorak, but the castle was impregnable and always had been. No avatar but Anorak himself had ever been able to pass through its entrance. But now I knew there must be a way to enter Castle Anorak, because the third gate was hidden somewhere inside. When I got back to my ship, I blasted off and set a course for Thonia in Sector 10. Then I began to scan the news feeds, intending to check out the media frenzy my return to first place was generating. But my score wasn't the top story. No, the big news that afternoon was that the hiding place of Halliday's Easter egg had, at long last, finally been revealed to the world. It was, the news anchors said, located somewhere on the planet Thonia inside Castle Anorak. They knew this because the entire Sixer army was now encamped around the castle. They'd arrived earlier that day, shortly after I'd cleared the second gate. I knew the timing couldn't be a coincidence. My progress must have prompted the Sixers to end their covert attempts to clear the third gate and make its location public by barricading it before I or anyone else could reach it. When I arrived at Thonia a few minutes later, I did a cloaked flyby of the castle just to gauge the lay of the land for myself. It was even worse than I'd imagined. The Sixers had installed some type of magical shield over Castle Anorak, a semi-transparent dome that completely covered the castle and the area around it. Encamped inside the shield wall was the entire Sixer army, a vast collection of troops, tanks, weapons, and vehicles surrounded the castle on all sides. Several Gunter clans were already on the scene, and they were making their first attempts to bring down the shield by launching high-yield nukes at it. Each detonation was followed by a brief atomic light show, and then the blast would dissipate harmlessly against the shield. The attacks on the shield continued for the next few hours as the news spread and more Gunters arrived on Thonia. The clans launched every type of weapon they could think of at the shield, but nothing affected it. Not nukes, not fireballs, and not magic missiles. Eventually, a team of Gunters tried to dig a tunnel under the dome wall, and that was when it was discovered that the shield was actually a complete sphere surrounding the castle, above and below ground. Later that night, several high-level Gunter wizards finished casting a series of divination spells on the castle and announced on the message boards that the shield around the castle was generated by a powerful artifact called the Orb of Ozuvox, which could only be operated by a wizard who was 99th level. According to the artifact's item description, it could create a spherical shield around itself with a circumference of up to half a kilometer. This shield was impenetrable and indestructible and could vaporize just about anything that touched it. It could also be kept up indefinitely as long as the wizard operating the orb remained immobile and kept both hands on the artifact. In the days that followed, Gunters tried everything they could think of to penetrate the shield. Magic, technology, teleportation, counterspells, other artifacts. Nothing worked. There was no way to get inside. An air of hopelessness quickly swept through the Gunter community. Solos and clansmen alike were ready to throw in the towel. The Sixers had the crystal key and exclusive access to the third gate. Everyone agreed that the end was near, that the hunt was all over but the crying. During all of these developments, I somehow managed to keep my cool. There was a chance the Sixers hadn't even figured out how to open the third gate yet. Of course, they had plenty of time now. They could be slow and methodical. Sooner or later, they would stumble on the solution. But I refused to give up. Until an avatar reached Halliday's Easter egg, anything was still possible. Like any classic video game, the hunt had simply reached a new, more difficult level. A new level often required an entirely new strategy. I began to formulate a plan. A bold, outrageous plan that would require epic amounts of luck to pull off. I set this plan in motion by emailing Artemis, H, and Shoto. My message told them exactly where to find the second gate and how to obtain the crystal key. Once I was sure all three of them had received my message, I initiated the next phase of my plan. This was the part that terrified me, because I knew there was a good chance it was going to end up getting me killed. But at this point, I no longer cared. I was going to reach the third gate or die trying. Level 3. Going outside is highly overrated. Anorak's Almanac, Chapter 17, Verse 32. Chapter 28. When the IOI corporate police came to arrest me, I was right in the middle of the movie Explorers, 1985, directed by Joe Dante. It's about three kids who build a spaceship in their backyard and then fly off to meet aliens. Easily one of the greatest kid flicks ever made. I'd gotten into the habit of watching it at least once a month. It kept me centered. I had a thumbnail of my apartment building's external security camera feed at the edge of my display, so I saw the IOI indentured servant retrieval transport pull up out front, siren wailing and lights flashing. Then, four jackbooted, riot-helmeted drop cops jumped out and ran into the building, followed by a guy in a suit. I continued to watch them on the lobby camera as they waved their IOI badges, blew past the security station, and filed onto the elevator. Now they were on their way up to my floor. "Max," I muttered, noting the fear in my own voice. "Execute security macro number one. Crom, strong in his mountain." This voice command instructed my computer to execute a long series of pre-programmed actions, both online and in the real world. "You got it, Chief," Max replied cheerfully. And a split second later, my apartment security system switched into lockdown mode. My reinforced plate titanium war door swung down from the ceiling, slamming and locking into place over my apartment's built-in security door. On the security camera mounted in the hallway outside my apartment, I watched the four drop cops get off the elevator and sprint down the hallway to my door. The two guys in front were carrying plasma welders. The other two held industrial-strength volt-jolt stun guns. The suit, who brought up the rear, was carrying a digital clipboard. I wasn't surprised to see them. I knew why they were here. They were here to cut open my apartment and pull me out of it, like a chunk of Spam being removed from a can. When they reached my door, my scanner gave them the once-over, and their ID data flashed on my display, informing me that all five of these men were IOI credit officers with a valid indenturement arrest warrant for one Bryce Lynch, the occupant of this apartment. So, in keeping with local, state, and federal law, my apartment building security system immediately opened both of my security doors to grant them entrance, but the war door that had just slammed into place kept them outside. Of course, the drop cops expected me to have redundant security, which is why they'd brought plasma welders. The IOI drone in the suit squeezed past the drop cops and gingerly pressed his thumb to my door intercom. His name and corporate title appeared on my display. Michael Wilson, IOI Credit and Collections Division, employee number IOI 481231. Wilson looked up into the lens of my hallway camera and smiled pleasantly. "Mr. Lynch," he said, "my name is Michael Wilson, and I'm with the Credit and Collections Division of Innovative Online Industries." He consulted his clipboard. "I'm here because you have failed to make the last three payments on your IOI Visa card, which has an outstanding balance in excess of $20,000. Our records also show that you are currently unemployed and have therefore been classified as impecunious. Under current federal law, you are now eligible for mandatory indenturement. You will remain indentured until you have paid your debt to our company in full, along with all applicable interest, processing and late fees, and any other charges or penalties that you incur henceforth." Wilson motioned toward the drop cops. "These gentlemen are here to assist me in apprehending you and escorting you to your new place of employment. We request that you open your door and grant us access to your residence. Please be aware that we are authorized to seize any personal belongings you have inside. The sale value of these items will, of course, be deducted from your outstanding credit balance." As far as I could tell, Wilson recited all of this without taking a single breath, speaking in the flat monotone of someone who repeats the same sentences all day long. After a brief pause, I replied through the intercom, "Sure thing, guys. Just give me a minute to get my pants on, then I'll be right out." Wilson frowned. "Mr. Lynch, if you do not grant us access to your residence within 10 seconds, we are authorized to enter by force. The cost of any damage resulting from our forced entry, including all property damage and repair labor, will be added to your outstanding balance. Thank you. Wilson stepped away from the intercom and nodded to the others. One of the drop cops immediately powered up his welder, and when the tip began to glow molten orange, he began cutting through my war door's titanium plating. The other welder moved a few feet farther down and began to cut a hole right through the wall of my apartment. These guys had access to the building's security specs, so they knew the walls of each apartment were lined with steel plating and a layer of concrete, which they could cut through much more quickly than the titanium war door. Of course, I'd taken the precaution of reinforcing my apartment's walls, floor, and ceiling with a titanium alloy sage cage, which I'd assembled piece by piece. Once they cut through my wall, they would have to cut through the cage, too. But this would buy me only 5 or 6 extra minutes at the most, then they would be inside. I'd heard that drop cops had a nickname for this procedure, cutting an indent out of a fortified residence so they could arrest him. They called it doing a C-section. I dry swallowed 2 of the anti-anxiety pills I'd ordered in preparation for this day. I'd already taken 2 earlier that morning, but they didn't seem to be working. Inside the Oasis, I closed all the windows on my display and set my account security level to maximum. Then, I pulled up the scoreboard just to check it one last time and reassure myself that nothing had changed and that the Sixers still hadn't won. The top 10 rankings had been static for several days now. High scores. Number 1, Artemis, 354,000. Number 2, Parzival, 353,000. Number 3, IOI, 655321, 352,000. Number 4, H, 352,000. Number 5, IOI, 643187, 349,000. Number 6, IOI, 621671, 348,000. Number 7, IOI 678324, 347,000. Number 8, Shoto, 347,000. Number 9, IOI 637330, 346,000. Number 10, IOI 699423, 346,000. Artemis, H, and Shoto had all cleared the second gate and obtained the crystal key within 48 hours of receiving my email. When Artemis received the 25,000 points for reaching the crystal key, it had put her back in first place due to the point bonuses she'd already received for finding the jade key first and the copper key second. Artemis, H, and Shoto had all tried to contact me since receiving my email, but I hadn't answered any of their phone calls, emails, or chat requests. I saw no reason to tell them what I intended to do. They couldn't do anything to help me and would probably just try to talk me out of it. There was no turning back now, anyway. I closed the scoreboard and took a long look around my stronghold, wondering if it was for the last time. Then I took several quick, deep breaths, like a deep sea diver preparing to submerge, and tapped the logout icon on my display. The Oasis vanished, and my avatar reappeared inside my virtual office, a standalone simulation stored on my console's hard drive. I opened a console window and keyed in the command word to activate my computer's self-destruct sequence. Shitstorm. A progress meter appeared on my display, showing that my hard drive was now being zeroed out and wiped clean. "Goodbye, Max," I whispered.
"Adios, Wade,"
Max said, just a few seconds before he was deleted. Sitting in my haptic chair, I could already feel the heat coming from the other side of the room. When I pulled off my visor, I saw smoke pouring in through the holes being cut in the door and the wall. It was starting to get too thick for my apartment's air purifiers to handle. I began to cough. The drop cop working on my door finished cutting his hole. The smoking circle of metal fell to the floor with a heavy metallic boom that made me jump in my chair. As the welder stepped back, another drop cop stepped forward and used a small canister to spray some sort of freezing foam around the edge of the hole, cooling off the metal so they wouldn't burn themselves when they crawled inside, which was what they were about to do.
"Clear,"
One of them shouted from out in the hallway, "No visible weapons!" One of the stun gun wielding drop cops climbed through the hole first. Suddenly, he was standing right in front of me, his weapon leveled at my face. "Don't move!" he shouted, "or you get the juice, understand?" I nodded that, yes, I understood. It occurred to me then that this cop was the first visitor I'd ever had in my apartment in all the time I'd lived there. The second drop cop to crawl inside wasn't nearly as polite. Without a word, he walked over and jammed a ball gag in my mouth. This was standard procedure because they didn't want me to issue any more voice commands to my computer. They needn't have bothered. The moment the first drop cop had entered my apartment, an incendiary device had detonated inside my computer. It was already melting to slag. When the drop cop finished strapping on the ball gag, he grabbed me by the exoskeleton of my haptic suit, yanked me out of my haptic chair like a rag doll, and threw me on the floor. The other drop cop hit the kill switch that opened my war door, and the last two drop cops rushed in, followed by Wilson the suit. I curled into a ball on the floor and closed my eyes. I started to shake involuntarily. I tried to prepare myself for what I knew was about to happen next. They were going to take me outside. "Mr. Lynch," Wilson said, smiling, "I hereby place you under corporate arrest." He turned to the drop cops. "Tell the repo team to come on up and clear this place out." He glanced around the room and noticed the thin line of smoke now pouring out of my computer. He looked at me and shook his head. "That was stupid. We could have sold that computer to help pay down your debt." I couldn't reply around the ball gag, so I just shrugged and gave him the finger. They tore off my haptic suit and left it for the repo team. I was totally naked underneath. They gave me a disposable slate-gray jumpsuit to put on, with matching plastic shoes. The suit felt like sandpaper, and it began to make me itch as soon as I put it on. They'd cuffed my hands, so it wasn't easy to scratch. They dragged me out into the hall. The harsh fluorescence sucked the color out of everything and made it look like an old black-and-white film. As we rode the elevator down to the lobby, I hummed along with the Muzak as loudly as I could to show them I wasn't afraid. When one of the drop cops waved his stun gun at me, I stopped. They put a hooded winter coat on me in the lobby. They didn't want me catching pneumonia now that I was company property, a human resource. Then they led me outside, and sunlight hit my face for the first time in over half a year. It was snowing, and everything was covered in a thin layer of gray ice and slush. I didn't know what the temperature was, but I couldn't remember ever feeling so cold. The wind cut right to my bones. They herded me over to their transport truck. Two new indents already sat in the back, strapped into plastic seats, both wearing visors. People they'd arrested earlier that morning. The drop cops were like garbage collectors, making their daily rounds. The indent on my right was a tall, thin guy, probably a few years older than me. He looked like he might be suffering from malnutrition. The other indent was morbidly obese, and I couldn't be sure of the person's gender. I decided to think of him as male. His face was obscured by a mop of dirty blonde hair, and something that looked like a gas mask covered his nose and mouth. A thick black tube ran from the mask down to a nozzle on the floor. I wasn't sure of its purpose until he lurched forward, drawing his restraints tight, and vomited into the mask. I heard a vacuum activate, sucking the indents regurgitated Oreos down the tube and into the floor. I wondered if they stored it in an external tank or just dumped it on the street. Probably a tank. IOI would probably have his vomit analyzed and put the results in his file. "You feel sick?" one of the drop cops asked as he removed my ball gag. "Tell me now, and I'll put a mask on you." "I feel great," I said, not very convincingly. "Okay, but if I have to clean up your puke, I'll make sure you regret it." They shoved me inside and strapped me down directly across from the skinny guy. Two of the drop cops climbed into the back with us, stowing their plasma welders in a locker. The other two slammed the rear doors and climbed into the cab up front. As we pulled away from my apartment complex, I craned my neck to look through the transport's tinted rear windows up at the building where I'd lived for the past year. I was able to spot my window up on the 42nd floor because of its spray-painted black glass. The repo team was probably already up there by now. All of my gear was being disassembled, inventoried, tagged, boxed, and prepared for auction. Once they finished emptying out my apartment, custodial bots would scour and disinfect it. A repair crew would patch the outer wall and replace the door. IOI would be billed, and the cost of the repairs would be added to my outstanding debt to the company. By mid-afternoon, the lucky Gunter who was next on the apartment building's waiting list would get a message informing him that a unit had opened up. And by this evening, the new tenant would probably already be moved in. By the time the sun went down, all evidence that I'd ever lived there would be totally erased. As the transport swung out onto High Street, I heard the tires crunch the salt crystals covering the frozen asphalt. One of the drop cops reached over and slapped a visor on my face. I found myself sitting on a sandy white beach, watching the sunset, while waves crashed in front of me. This must be the simulation they used to keep in dense calm during the ride downtown. Using my cuffed hand, I pushed the visor up onto my forehead. The drop cops didn't seem to care or pay me any notice at all. So I craned my head again to stare out the window. I hadn't been out here in the real world for a long time, and I wanted to see how it had changed. Chapter 29. A thick film of neglect still covered everything in sight. The streets, the buildings, the people. Even the snow seemed dirty. It drifted down in gray flakes, like ash after a volcanic eruption. The number of homeless people seemed to have increased drastically. Tents and cardboard shelters lined the streets, and the public parks I saw seemed to have been converted into refugee camps. As the transport rolled deeper into the city's skyscraper core, I saw people clustered on every street corner and in every vacant lot, huddled around burning barrels and portable fuel cell heaters. Others waited in line at the free solar charging stations, wearing bulky, outdated visors and haptic gloves. Their hands made small, ghostly gestures as they interacted with the far more pleasant reality of the Oasis via one of GSS's free wireless access points. Finally, we reached 101 IOI Plaza in the heart of downtown. I stared out the window in silent apprehension as the corporate headquarters of Innovative Online Industries Incorporated came into view. Two rectangular skyscrapers flanking a circular one, forming the IOI corporate logo. The IOI skyscrapers were the three tallest buildings in the city, mighty towers of steel and mirrored glass joined by dozens of connective walkways and elevator trams. The top of each tower disappeared into the sodium vapor-drenched cloud layer above. The buildings looked identical to their headquarters in the Oasis on IOI 1, but here in the real world, they seemed much more impressive. The transport rolled into a parking garage at the base of the circular tower and descended a series of concrete ramps until we arrived in a large open area resembling a loading dock. A sign over a row of wide bay doors read, IOI Indentured Employee Induction Center. The other indents and I were herded off the transport where a squad of stun gun-armed security guards was waiting to take custody of us. Our handcuffs were removed. Then another guard began to swipe each of us with a handheld retina scanner. I held my breath as he held the scanner up to my eyes. A second later, the unit beeped and he read off the information on its display. Lynch, Bryce, age 22, full citizenship. No criminal record, credit default indenturement. He nodded to himself and tapped a series of icons on his clipboard. Then I was led into a warm, brightly lit room filled with hundreds of other new indents. They were all shuffling through a maze of guide ropes like weary overgrown children at some nightmarish amusement park. There seemed to be an equal number of men and women, but it was hard to tell because nearly everyone shared my pale complexion and total lack of body hair, and we all wore the same gray jumpsuits and gray plastic shoes. We looked like extras from THX-1138. The line fed into a series of security checkpoints. At the first checkpoint, each indent was given a thorough scan with a brand new metadetector to make sure they weren't hiding any electronic devices on or in their persons. While I waited for my turn, I saw several people pulled out of line when the scanner found a subcutaneous mini-computer or a voice-controlled phone installed as a tooth replacement. They were led into another room to have the devices removed. A dude just ahead of me in line actually had a top-of-the-line miniature Synatro Oasis console concealed inside a prosthetic testicle. Talk about balls. Once I'd cleared a few more checkpoints, I was ushered into the testing area, a giant room filled with hundreds of small, soundproofed cubicles. I was seated in one of them and given a cheap visor and an even cheaper pair of haptic gloves. The gear didn't give me access to the Oasis, but I still found it comforting to put it on. I was then given a battery of increasingly difficult aptitude tests, intended to measure my knowledge and abilities in every area that might conceivably be of use to my new employer. These tests were, of course, cross-referenced with the fake educational background and work history that I'd given to my bogus Bryce Lynch identity. I made sure to ace all of the tests on Oasis software, hardware, and networking, but I intentionally failed the tests designed to gauge my knowledge of James Halliday and the Easter egg. I definitely didn't want to get placed in IOI's oology division. There was a chance I might run into Sorrento there. I didn't think he'd recognize me. We'd never actually met in person, and I now barely resembled my old school ID photo, but I didn't want to risk it. I was already tempting fate more than anyone in their right mind ever would. Hours later, when I finally finished the last exam, I was logged into a virtual chat room to meet with an indenturement counselor. Her name was Nancy, and in a hypnotic monotone, she informed me that, due to my exemplary test scores and impressive employment record, I had been awarded the position of Oasis Technical Support Representative 2. I would be paid $28,500 a year, minus the cost of my housing, meals, taxes, medical, dental, optical, and recreation services, all of which would be deducted automatically from my pay. My remaining income, if there was any, would be applied to my outstanding debt to the company. Once my debt was paid in full, I would be released from indenturement. At that time, based on my job performance, it was possible I would be offered a permanent position with IOI. This was a complete joke, of course. Indents were never able to pay off their debt and earn their release. Once they got finished slapping you with pay deductions, late fees, and interest penalties, you wound up owing them more each month instead of less. Once you made the mistake of getting yourself indentured, you would probably remain indentured for life. A lot of people didn't seem to mind this, though. They thought of it as job security. It also meant they weren't going to starve or freeze to death in the street. My indenturement contract appeared in a window on my display. It contained a long list of disclaimers and warnings about my rights, or lack thereof, as an indentured employee. Nancy told me to read it, sign it, and proceed to indent processing. Then she logged out of the chat room. I scrolled to the bottom of the contract without bothering to read it. It was over 600 pages long. I signed the name Bryce Lynch, then verified my signature with a retinal scan. Even though I was using a fake name, I wondered if the contract might still be legally binding. I wasn't sure, and I didn't really care. I had a plan, and this was part of it. They led me down another corridor into the indenturement processing area. I was placed on a conveyor belt that carried me through a long series of stations. First, they took my jumpsuit and shoes and incinerated them. Then they ran me through a kind of human car wash, a series of machines that soaped, scrubbed, disinfected, rinsed, dried, and deloused me. Afterward, I was given a new gray jumpsuit and another pair of plastic slippers. At the next station, a bank of machines gave me a complete physical, including a battery of blood tests. Luckily, the Genetic Privacy Act made it illegal for IOI to sample my DNA. Then I was given a series of inoculations with an array of automated needle guns that shot me in both shoulders and both ass cheeks simultaneously. As I inched forward along the conveyor, flat-screen monitors mounted overhead showed the same 10-minute training film over and over on an endless loop. Indentured servitude, your fast track from debt to success. The cast was made up of D-list television stars who cheerfully spouted corporate propaganda while relating the minutiae of IOI's indenturement policy. After 5 viewings, I had every line of the damn thing memorized. By the 10th viewing, I was mouthing the words along with the actors. What can I expect after I complete my initial processing and get placed in my permanent position? Asked Johnny, the training film's main character. You can expect to spend the rest of your life as a corporate slave, Johnny, I thought. But I kept watching as, once again, the helpful IOI human resources rep pleasantly told Johnny all about the day-to-day life of an indent. Finally, I reached the last station, where a machine fitted me with a security anklet, a padded metal band that locked around my ankle just above the joint. According to the training film, this device monitored my physical location and also granted or denied me access to different areas of the IOI office complex. If I tried to escape, remove the anklet, or cause trouble of any kind, the device was capable of delivering a paralyzing electrical shock. If necessary, it could also administer a heavy-duty tranquilizer directly into my bloodstream. After the anklet was on, another machine clamped a small, electronic device onto my right earlobe, piercing it in 2 locations. I winced in pain and shouted a stream of profanity. I knew from the training film that I'd just been fitted with an OCT. OCT stood for Observation and Communication Tag, but most indents just referred to it as ear gear. It reminded me of the tags environmentalists used to put on endangered animals to track their movements in the wild. The ear gear contained a tiny comlink that allowed the main IOI human resources computer to make announcements and issue commands directly into my ear. It also contained a tiny forward-looking camera that let IOI supervisors see whatever was directly in front of me. Surveillance cameras were mounted in every room in the IOI complex, but that apparently wasn't enough. They also had to mount the camera to the side of every indent's head. A few seconds after my ear gear was attached and activated, I began to hear the placid monotone of the HR mainframe, droning instructions and other information. The voice drove me nuts at first, but I gradually got used to it. I didn't have much choice. As I stepped off the conveyor, the HR computer directed me to a nearby cafeteria that looked like something out of an old prison movie. I was given a lime-green tray of food, a tasteless soy burger, a lump of runny mashed potatoes, and some unrecognizable form of cobbler for dessert. I devoured all of it in a few minutes. The HR computer complimented me on my healthy appetite. Then it informed me that I was now permitted to make a 5-minute visit to the bathroom. When I came out, I was directed onto an elevator with no buttons or floor indicator. When the doors slid open, I saw the following stenciled on the wall. Indent Hab, Block 05, Tech Sup Reps. I shuffled off the elevator and down the carpeted hallway. It was quiet and dark. The only illumination came from small path lighting embedded in the floor. I'd lost track of the time. It seemed like days had passed since I'd been pulled out of my apartment. I was dead on my feet. Your first technical support shift begins in 7 hours, the HR computer droned softly in my ear. You have until then to sleep. Turn left at the intersection in front of you and proceed to your assigned HAB unit, number 42G. I continued to do as I was told. I thought I was already getting pretty good at it. The HAB block reminded me of a mausoleum. It was a network of vaulted hallways, each lined with coffin-shaped sleeping capsules, row after row of them, stacked to the ceiling, 10 high. Each column of HAB units was numbered, and the door of each capsule was lettered A through J, with Unit A at the bottom. I eventually reached my unit near the top of column number 42. As I approached it, the hatch irised open with a hiss, and a soft blue light winked on inside. I ascended the narrow access ladder mounted between the adjacent rows of capsules, then stepped onto the short platform beneath the hatch to my unit. When I climbed inside the capsule, the platform retracted and the hatch irised shut at my feet. The inside of my HAB unit was an eggshell white injection molded plastic coffin, 1 meter high, 1 meter wide, and 2 meters long. The floor of the capsule was covered with a gel foam mattress pad and pillow. They both smelled like burned rubber, so I assumed they must be new. In addition to the camera attached to the side of my head, there was a camera mounted above the door of my HAB unit. The company didn't bother hiding it. They wanted their indents to know they were being watched. The unit's only amenity was the entertainment console, a large, flat touch screen built into the wall. A wireless visor was snapped into a holder beside it. I tapped the touch screen, activating the unit. My new employee number and position appeared at the top of the display. Lynch, Bryce T., Oasis Tech Rep 2, IOI employee number 338645. A menu appeared below, listing the entertainment programming to which I presently had access. It took only a few seconds to peruse my limited options. I could view only one channel, IOIN, the company's 24-hour news network. It provided a nonstop stream of company-related news and propaganda. I also had access to a library of training films and simulations, most of which were geared toward my new position as an Oasis technical support representative. When I tried to access one of the other entertainment libraries, Vintage Movies, the system informed me that I wouldn't be granted access to a wider selection of entertainment options until I had received an above-average rating in 3 consecutive employee performance reviews. Then the system asked me if I wanted more information on the Indentured Employee Entertainment Reward Program. I didn't. The only TV show I had access to was a company-produced sitcom called Tommy Q. The synopsis said it was a wacky situation comedy chronicling the misadventures of Tommy, a newly indentured Oasis tech rep struggling to achieve his goals of financial independence and on-the-job excellence. I selected the first episode of Tommy Q, then unsnapped the visor and put it on. As I expected, the show was really just a training film with a laugh track. I had absolutely no interest in it. I just wanted to go to sleep. But I knew I was being watched, and that every move I made was being scrutinized and logged. So I stayed awake as long as I could, ignoring one episode of Tommy Q after another. Despite my best efforts, my thoughts drifted to Artemis. Regardless of what I'd been telling myself, I knew she was the real reason I'd gone through with this lunatic plan. What the hell was wrong with me? There was a good chance I might never escape from this place. I felt buried under an avalanche of self-doubt. Had my dual obsessions with the egg and Artemis finally driven me completely insane? Why would I take such an idiotic risk to win over someone I'd never actually met? Someone who appeared to have no interest in ever talking to me again. Where was she right now? Did she miss me? I continued to mentally torture myself like that until I finally drifted off to sleep. Chapter 30. IOI's technical support call center occupied 3 entire floors of the headquarters' eastern I-shaped tower. Each of these floors contained a maze of numbered cubicles. Mine was stuck back in a remote corner, far from any windows. My cubicle was completely empty, except for an adjustable office chair bolted to the floor. Several of the cubicles around me were unoccupied, awaiting the arrival of other new indents. I wasn't permitted to have any decorations in my cubicle because I hadn't earned that privilege yet. If I obtained a sufficient number of perk points by getting high productivity and customer approval ratings, I could spend some of them to purchase the privilege of decorating my cube, perhaps with a potted plant or an inspirational poster of a kitten hanging from a clothesline. When I arrived in my cubicle, I grabbed my company-issued visor and gloves from the rack on the bare cube wall and put them on. Then I collapsed into my chair. My work computer was built into the chair's circular base, and it activated itself automatically when I sat down. My employee ID was verified, and I was automatically logged into my work account on the IOI intranet. I wasn't allowed to have any outbound access to the Oasis. All I could really do was read work-related emails, view support documentation and procedural manuals, and check my call time statistics. That was it. And every move I made on the intranet was closely monitored, controlled, and logged. I put myself in the call queue and began my 12-hour shift. I'd been an indent for only 8 days now, but it already felt like I'd been imprisoned here for years. The first caller's avatar appeared in front of me in my support chat room. His name and stats also appeared, floating in the air above him. He had the astoundingly clever name of Hotcock 007. I could see that it was going to be another fabulous day. Hotcock 007 was a hulking bald barbarian with studded black leather armor and lots of demon tattoos covering his arms and face. He was holding a gigantic bastard sword nearly twice as long as his avatar's body. "Good morning, Mr. Hotcock 007, I droned. "Thank you for calling technical support. I'm tech rep number 338645. How may I help you this evening?" The customer courtesy software filtered my voice, altering its tone and inflection to ensure that I always sounded cheerful and upbeat.
Yeah, Hotcock 007 began. "I just bought this badass sword, and now I can't even use it. I can't even attack nothing with it. What the hell is wrong with this piece of shit? Is it broke?"
"Sir, the only problem is that you're a complete fucking moron," I said. I heard a familiar warning buzzer and a message flashed on my display. "Courtesy violation. Flags. Fucking. Moron. Last response muted. Violation logged." IOI's patented customer courtesy software had detected the inappropriate nature of my response and muted it, so the customer didn't hear what I'd said. The software also logged my courtesy violation and forwarded it to Trevor, my section supervisor, so that he could bring it up during my next biweekly performance review.
"Sir, did you purchase this sword in an online auction?"
"Yeah," Hotcock 007 replied.
"Paid out the ass for it, too."
"Just a moment, sir, while I examine the item." I already knew what his problem was, but I needed to make sure before telling him, or I'd get hit with a fine. I tapped the sword with my index finger, selecting it. A small window opened and displayed the item's properties. The answer was right there on the first line. This particular magic sword could only be used by an avatar who was 10th level or higher. Mr. Hotcock 007 was only 7th level. I quickly explained this to him.
"What? That ain't fair. The guy who sold it to me didn't say nothing about that."
"Sir, it's always advisable to make sure your avatar can actually use an item before you purchase it."
"God damn it!" he shouted. "Well, what am I supposed to do with it now?"
"You could shove it up your ass and pretend you're a corn dog." "Courtesy violation. Response muted. Violation logged." I tried again.
"Sir, you might want to keep the item stored in your inventory until your avatar has attained 10th level, or you may wish to put the item back up for auction yourself and use the proceeds to purchase a similar weapon. One with a power level commensurate to that of your avatar."
"Huh?" Hotcock 007 responded. "What do you mean?"
"Save it or sell it."
"Oh.
Can I help you with anything else today, sir?"
No, I don't guess. Great. Thank you for calling technical support. Have an outstanding day. I tapped the disconnect icon on my display, and Hotcock 007 vanished. Call time, 2 minutes, 7 seconds. As the next customer's avatar appeared, a red-skinned, large-breasted alien female named Vartax, the customer satisfaction rating that Hotcock 007 had just given me appeared on my display. It was a 6, out of a possible score of 10. The system then helpfully reminded me that I needed to keep my average above 8.5 if I wanted to get a raise after my next review. Doing tech support here was nothing like working from home. Here, I couldn't watch movies, play games, or listen to music while I answered the endless stream of inane calls. The only distraction was staring at the clock, or the IOI stock ticker, which was always at the top of every indent's display. You couldn't get rid of it. During each shift, I was given 3 5-minute restroom breaks. Lunch was 30 minutes. I usually ate in my cubicle instead of the cafeteria, so I wouldn't have to listen to the other tech reps bitch about their calls or boast about how many perk points they'd earned. I'd grown to despise the other indents almost as much as the customers. I fell asleep 5 separate times during my shift. Each time, when the system saw that I'd drifted off, it sounded a warning klaxon in my ears, jolting me back awake. Then it noted the infraction in my employee data file. My narcolepsy had become such a consistent problem during my first week that I was now being issued 2 little red pills each day to help me stay awake. I took them too, but not until after I got off work. When my shift finally ended, I ripped off my headset and visor and walked back to my HAB unit as quickly as I could. This was the only time each day I ever hurried anywhere. When I reached my tiny plastic coffin, I crawled inside and collapsed on the mattress, face down, in the same exact position as the night before, and the night before that. I lay there for a few minutes, staring at the time readout on my entertainment console out of the corner of my eye. When it reached 7:07 p.m., I rolled over and sat up. "Lights," I said softly. This had become my favorite word over the past week. In my mind, it had become synonymous with freedom. The lights embedded in the shell of my HAB unit shut off, plunging the tiny compartment into darkness. If someone had been watching either of my live security vid feeds, they would have seen a brief flash as the cameras switched to night vision mode. Then I would have been clearly visible on their monitors once again. But, thanks to some sabotage I'd performed earlier in the week, the security cameras in my HAB unit and my ear gear were now no longer performing their assigned tasks. So, for the first time that day, I wasn't being watched. That meant it was time to rock. I tapped the Entertainment Center console's touchscreen. It lit up, presenting me with the same choices I'd had on my first night here. A handful of training films and simulations, including the complete run of Tommy Q episodes. If anyone checked the usage logs for my Entertainment Center, they would show that I had watched Tommy Q every night until I fell asleep, and that once I'd worked my way through all 16 episodes, I'd started over at the beginning. The logs would also show that I fell asleep at roughly the same time every night, but not at exactly the same time, and that I slept like the dead until the following morning when my alarm sounded. Of course, I hadn't really been watching their inane corporate shitcom every night, and I wasn't sleeping either. I'd actually been operating on about 2 hours of sleep a night for the past week, and it was beginning to take its toll on me. But the moment the lights in my HAB unit went out, I felt energized and wide awake. My exhaustion seemed to vanish as I began to navigate through the Entertainment Center operation menus from memory, the fingers of my right hand dancing rapidly across the touchscreen. About 7 months earlier, I'd obtained a set of IOI intranet passwords from the Leet Hacksor's warehouse, the same black market data auction site where I'd purchased the information needed to create a new identity. I kept an eye on all of the black market data sites because you never knew what might be up for sale on them. Oasis server exploits, ATM hacks, celebrity sex tapes,
You name it. I'd been browsing through the Leet Hacksaw's warehouse auction listings when one in particular caught my eye. IOI Intranet Access Passwords, Backdoors, and System Exploits. The seller claimed to be offering classified proprietary information on IOI's intranet architecture,